Last Sunday, I started talking about debt and how we should avoid it at all costs. I gave 14 different reasons why we should avoid debt like the plague. And I want to continue talking about debt today. And I want to talk about how it's foolish to be in debt, first of all. I want to talk about a broke person versus a wealthy person mindset. I want to talk about and dispel the build your credit myth that's out there that everybody loves to tell you about and how wonderful an idea that is. And then I want to talk about how we should not buy a house until we are financially prepared to do so. And I'll give you the stipulations for that. And I also have some facts and figures about the housing situation in our country today and how it's absolutely unaffordable. I don't know if I'll get any further than that. I do have a little bit more left in the outline, but I probably won't get past that point. So, as I talked about last Sunday, it is foolish to be in debt. And I'm going to give you a couple of more reasons for that. And this is a really important one here. And that is that the Bible likens sin unto debt. It actually refers to sin as debt, or debt as sin. In Matthew 6 and verse 12, this is in the Lord's Prayer. And when you compare the two renderings of the Lord's Prayer, the one in Matthew and the other in Luke, we'll see here this comparison between sin and debt. In Matthew 6 and verse 12, Jesus said these famous, familiar words, "And forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors." Now, keep your finger there and turn to Luke 11 and verse 4, and you'll notice something interesting. Luke 11 and verse 4, this is the same prayer, just said in slightly different words. Jesus said, "And forgive us our sins, for we also forgive everyone that is indebted to us." So, forgive us our sins, forgive us our debts, put it together, sin is called debt, debt is called sin. So, I would say this passage gives a new meaning to the phrase, living in sin. You know, we think living in sin, you're shacking up, you're fornicating. Well, living in sin could also be living in a bunch of excessive debt as well. Romans 13 and verse 8 gives us a very short, succinct, plain, easy to understand commandment. Romans 13 and verse 8. Owe no man anything. That's pretty simple, isn't it? Owe no man anything. Except there's one caveat in the verse. But to love one another. For he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. You can owe somebody love. But that's about it. That's about it. Owe no man anything. So who can you owe anything to? No man. That leaves no wiggle room. And what can you owe? Nothing. Not anything. Nothing. Right? So there's the bar. Owe no man anything. That means you shouldn't be in debt. You shouldn't owe people things, if at all possible. Proverbs 22 and verse 7. Familiar verse. I've been over it a time or two. Probably be over it a time or two more in this series because it's such an important verse. Foundational verse when it comes to dealing with money, finances, debt. Proverbs 22 and verse 7. The rich ruleth over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. And as I talked about last Sunday, servant is a slave, a bond servant. So if you are in debt, you are a slave. And to the degree to which you're in debt, you are to that degree more and more of a slave. To the point where you can get to the point where you are so far in debt, you literally are like a slave where you can't do anything. You are maxed out. You are at your end of your rope. You can do nothing. You are completely in bond servitude. So the further in debt you go, the further in slavery you go. Let me give you an example of this in Nehemiah 5, 3 through 5. Now, if you know anything about the Bible, if you know anything about natural rights, if you know anything about just about anything, you know that being a slave is not a preferable situation. Right? I think everybody probably knows that much. Nehemiah 5:3-5. But you know, there are some people out there that actually prefer being a slave, because when you're a slave, you don't really have a lot of responsibility. You just do what somebody else tells you to. You don't have to worry about providing for yourself. You don't have to worry about anything except just doing the work. And if you do the work, you don't get beaten and you're fine. You know, everything's taken care of. I don't have any freedom. Yeah, I can't do what I want, but I'm provided for. I've got housing. I've got food. I've got clothing. Well, okay, so what if I have no freedom? Right? Some people feel that way. I don't. And I hope you don't. But there are some people that are perfectly okay with just sitting at home, collecting checks from the government, being on welfare, not working, not doing anything. Yeah, they're a slave, but they're all right with that. That's cool. Everything's provided for me. I'm good. But that's not the America that the founders founded. That's not the America that I grew up in, or maybe it was. But anyway, that's not the America that I grew up thinking about America as. Nehemiah 5:3-5. Some also there were that said, "We have mortgaged our lands, vineyards, and houses, that we might buy corn because of the dearth." You see, they didn't have enough money saved up. They didn't have an emergency fund. And when the dearth comes, and now there's a famine, now they have to mortgage their lands and their vineyards and their houses. They got to go into debt just to pay for their basic necessities because they apparently hadn't planned well. There were also that said, "We have borrowed money for the king's tribute and that upon our lands and vineyards." Now they're borrowing money to pay their taxes. That's a really bad idea. If you got to borrow money to pay your taxes, you're in some bad shape. "Yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children. And lo, we bring into bondage our sons and our daughters to be servants. And some of our daughters are brought unto bondage already. Neither is it in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and vineyards." See, these people are like Americans today, just strapped with debt, mortgaged to the, you know, as far as the eye can see. And what are they in? Bondage. What are their children in? Bondage. They're slaves. They're slaves. That's what it is when you're in debt. And when you're in debt, when you're a slave, you have less rights. I think you probably already knew that, but let's turn to Exodus 21 and verses 2 and 21. I'm just trying to really hammer home the point that you do not want to be in debt. Anybody that's in debt, it should be your number one goal to get out of debt as soon as possible. It is a terrible position to be in. Exodus 21 and verse 2. "If thou buy an Hebrew servant 6 years, he shall serve. And in the seventh year, he shall go free for nothing." So this is a slave, right? He was bought. He's owned by somebody else. And in this case, they could own him for 6 years and then he would go free the seventh year. But look at what else is said here about a slave in verses 20 and 21. You see, slaves have less rights than free men do. "And if a man smite his servant or his maid with a rod and he die under his hand, he shall surely be punished. Notwithstanding, if he continue a day or two, he shall not be punished, for he is his money." Think about that. That man, that slave, was called his money. He was his possession. He is his money. Yes, if he smites him and he dies the same day, yeah, you're going to be in trouble. But if he smites him and he doesn't die and he continues a day or two, it's just your money, God says. I mean, think about that. This is the God of heaven saying that if you are a slave, and you could be a slave by selling yourself if you were in debt in those days, if you're a slave because you were too far in debt, God says you're somebody else's money. Think about that. So if you have debt or you have a loan, do you know that you are the bank's money? You are the bank's money. You are their money. At least to that extent. They don't control everything about you, but they control plenty about you. You don't pay that debt and they're coming after you. You are their money. And they care about you just about as much as this wicked slave owner who beat his slave and killed him, or almost killed him. That's how much the bank cares about you. They don't care about you one iota. You are their money. And we are not to be the servants of men. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 23. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 23. I know this sermon is probably would not be popular among pretty much anybody, because our country is in debt up to their eyeballs, and most people would hate me if they heard this. But I believe it's nevertheless true and needs to be said. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 23. The Lord says, ye are bought with a, or Paul said, ye are bought with a price. Be not ye the servants of men. Yes, you are Christ's servant, he said in the previous verse. That's the only place that it's cool and good to be a slave. You can be Christ's slave. You should be Christ's slave. You should do his bidding. You should be under his absolute control and do whatever he says and only do what he says. Yes, that's true. But we should not be the servants of men. We should not be the servants of bankers, loan sharks, credit card companies, people like that. So to be debt-free is to be free. You're not free if you're in debt, you're not free. You can sing Land of the Free and the Star-Spangled Banner and America the Great and all this stuff all you want, but if you're in debt, you are not free. You are a slave to the extent that you are in debt. Now remember, I said this last Sunday. I'm going to make the point again. It's foolish to be in debt because you end up paying more for whatever you buy. Let me give you an example. Let's just say that I am a couch salesman, and I've got two couches. And they're both identical. They're both brand new. They're both leather. They're both brown. They're exactly the same, 100% identical couches. And I say, I've got one couch here. I'll sell this one to you for $1,000. Or I've got this couch, which is absolutely identical in every single way. I'll sell this one to you for $2,000. What would it say about a person if he says, I'll take the one for $2,000? Foolish. Dumb, stupid, doesn't understand money, right? All those kind of things. That's probably what you'd be thinking about such a person. But do you realize that's what people do every single time you opt to take a loan out for something instead of buying it? You said, I'll take the one that's twice as expensive because of interest, especially if you put it on a credit card. If it's a regular loan, maybe you won't pay twice as much for it, but you'll pay a lot more for it. It's funny. Nobody would ever pick the $2,000 one, except they do every time, almost, by swiping the card for it and paying $2,000 for a $1,000 couch. Here's another reason not to be in debt, if you're a conservative or a libertarian. Now, if you are some kind of a lefty, woke, statist, communist, socialist, then yes, be in debt because you're practicing what you preach. But if you're a conservative or a libertarian, and you're in debt, you're a hypocrite. Because how can you criticize the government for its deficits and be in debt yourself? Think about it. You need to take the beam out of your own eye before you try to take the mote out of Washington, D.C.'s eye. Let's look at Matthew 7, 1 through 5. How many conservatives out there, how many Trump supporters, how many Republicans would get up on their soapbox, up on their high horse, and condemn the government for this spending? It's funny, they support Trump, who runs up the deficit trillions and trillions of dollars, but they condemn the same spending out of the other side of their mouth. But so you got this Republican, and he stands up there on his soapbox and condemns the government for this wasteful spending, and they're running up deficits, and they're spending more than they make, and the dude's in debt up to his eyeballs, like just about every American is. Think about that. Matthew 7, 1 through 5. Judge not that ye be not judged, for with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. And with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. And why beholdest thou the mote that is in thy brother's eye, but considerest not the beam that is in thine own eye? Or how wilt thou say to thy brother, let me pull out the mote that is in thine eye, and behold, a beam is in thine own eye? Thou hypocrite! first cast out the beam out of thine own eye, and then shalt thou see clearly to cast out the mote out of thy brother's eye. So if you're going to judge somebody else for something, you better make sure that you have got that same area in your own life cleaned up. And then one more reason why not to be in debt is that a person who is in debt is contributing to our country's demise. May not realize it, but it is true. Every time a loan is made, new money is created. I don't think a lot of people understand that. But when a loan is made, new money is created, which inflates and dilutes the money supply. Like, you know, banks don't really have much money. Like actual, much physical money. If you had a large amount of money in a bank and you went there and you asked them to take it out, they'd probably have to call in an armored car to bring in cash to the bank. Like, they don't actually have money at the bank, right? You probably knew that, maybe. So when somebody takes a loan out, the bank just conjures it up out of thin air. They get a loan from the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve just conjures it up out of thin air, most of it. They only have to keep like 10% of their money in reserve or something. So every time a loan is made, just more and more money is just created out of nowhere, which inflates and dilutes the money supply. Now, if you had like a real free market system, saving money creates reserves that businesses can borrow from to invest in producer goods, which then they can use to create consumer goods, and then that grows the economy. That creates economic growth. Producer goods are an economist's jargon for machines, capital equipment, things like that, that produce the actual stuff that we like to consume, right? So in that type of an economy, like a real economy, people would save money. That money would then be available for businesses to invest in their business to produce more stuff, which grows the economy, which produces more things, which increases the standard of living of everybody. But on the flip side of that, borrowing money for consumer goods just wastes resources and increases the trade deficit. Right? Borrowing money for consumer debt is consumer goods is stupid. There's no return on your investment. Right? If a business, which I think businesses should run at the speed of cash, but even if they don't, which most of them don't, if a business borrows money to invest in a machine, and that machine over the next few years can pay off that loan and then produce all kinds of more income on top of it, that's a good investment, right? But if you borrow money to buy the thing that that machine produced, and the thing that that machine produced, like the car or whatever, just goes down and down and down and down in value, borrowing money for a depreciating asset is just dumb, right? So borrowing money for consumer goods is stupid. Saving money, which enables businesses to borrow to produce more stuff, that makes economic sense. All right, now I want to talk about something that I had mentioned a while back. I kind of got ahead of myself in different parts of this sermon. Like I said, everything's all kind of interconnected, and I talked about this before, but I want to mention it again because I think it's so important, very crucial. And that is the broke person mindset versus the wealthy person mindset. Because wealthy people and broke people think very differently. And that's generally speaking, not always, but that's generally speaking why the wealthy person's wealthy and the broke person's broke. It's because of a mindset. It's how they think about things and about money. When a wealthy person, or even just a financially responsible person, this doesn't have to be a wealthy person, just a financially responsible person, which wealthy people are financially responsible, or they wouldn't be wealthy, right? Or they won't be wealthy for long if they're not. But when a financially responsible person is considering a purchase, he asks a question. How much? How much? That's what he thinks. If he's thinking about buying a house, a car, furniture, college education, whatever, he thinks and he asks, how much does this cost? When a broke person is considering a purchase, he asks, how much down and how much per month? That's what broke people do. And that's why they're broke, and they'll always be broke. Because they don't think in terms of actually paying for things. They don't think in terms of how much does this actually cost. They think about how much will it cost me per month. And when you think like that, you behave like that. And you're going to be paying out payments every month for the rest of your life, getting absolutely nowhere. You're paying interest instead of making it. until you stop thinking in terms of how much per month you're going to be broke the rest of your life. Now, when I say broke, I've defined this term before, but let me do it again. I'm not talking about living in poverty. I'm talking about the average American, paycheck to paycheck, barely saving anything, nothing laid up for retirement. You know, he's doing all right as long as he doesn't lose his job, after which he's got about a week and then he's screwed, right? That's what I'm talking about. You've got to stop thinking in terms of how much per month and start thinking in terms of how much, and I'll save up the money and pay for the thing. See, our culture has a broke person mindset. Just go to the car dealer and ask. Just do this for an experiment. I should do this one of these days. I haven't been to a car dealership I walk through one almost every day, but I haven't actually been to one to look at a car for, decades. I don't remember. It's been a long, long time. But anyway, go to a car dealership and ask the following question. How much will this car cost me out the door? And I'd be willing to bet, I'd bet another 50 cents on this one. I'd be willing to bet that 100% of the time you're going to get an answer of $500 a month, $600 a month, $800 a month, whatever. That's not what I asked. I asked, how much does this thing cost out the door? But he doesn't even think like that. He doesn't think like, oh, you're actually going to pay for it. No, he's thinking about, oh, here's how much it'll cost you per month. The same thing's true with a realtor. Do this sometime. I did this. Went to an open house. And I wasn't being a smart aleck. I wasn't trying to be cute or whatever. I was being completely honest. I'd never bought a house before. And I don't know what the total costs are, closing costs and all that kind of stuff. And so I wanted to know, like, what would the total cost of this house be? And that's what I asked him. Like, what would this house totally cost, you know, with everything? He gets out his phone. He punches in a mortgage calculator. Oh, $1,200 a month. Or I don't remember what it was, but something. I'm like, and I was just kind of like, what? Like, because I'm not thinking that at all. I want to know, like, what does it cost? And he's telling me a mortgage payment. And when I said, no, I want to know what it costs, like the total cost of the house. I'll have to get back to you on that. Like, I've never been asked that question before. It's like, but that's everybody. The only thing they think about is debt. They only think of monthly payments. They can't get out of that mindset. Never even crosses their mind that somebody might actually be paying for a car or a house. And if you get used to thinking like that, it's almost like learning a foreign language. When you're speaking in the foreign language, you need to think in the language that you're speaking in. And so if you start thinking like that, when you talk to other people that have like the normal American mindset, you're going to have to think like, oh, I'm talking in a foreign language now. I'm going to have to remember what they're talking about. When they say it costs this much, they're actually saying this is the monthly payment, right? When they say I can afford this, they mean they can afford to pay this much per month, right? They don't actually have the money for it, right? So you gotta translate. Now I want to talk about the build your credit myth. This was kind of an eye opener for me when I was reading Ramsey's books, and this is probably one of the most believed myths out there, one of them. Anyway, how many of you have ever heard, build your credit, build your credit? It's really important to build your credit. You've got to build your credit. Why would you need to build your credit? To go into debt. There's one reason to build your credit, to go into debt. If you're not going to go into debt, you don't need to build your credit at all. Your credit is meaningless. We're all encouraged, though, to build our credit today as if it's some kind of a status symbol. But I want to tell you something. Your credit score has nothing to do with how much money you have. You know that? Nothing. You could be a billionaire and have a zero credit score. As a matter of fact, Dave Ramsey is darn near a billionaire. You know what his credit score is? He doesn't have one. It's not zero. It's just nothing. There is, when you go in Experian, you look up Dave Ramsey and it says no information. He has no credit score. The other Ramsey personalities on there have no credit score. They're not billionaires. They may be, millionaires, some of them, they might not even be that, but they have no credit score because they don't use credit. Your credit score has nothing to do with how much money you have or even how trustworthy you are for that matter. It really doesn't. I have a good credit score, and I'll be honest with you, I couldn't care less about it. It doesn't matter one iota to me. And credit scores, at least my experience, they tend to move like for no reason, or I don't know what the reasons are, for a long time, my credit score, and I'm not boasting, like I said, it doesn't matter, I don't care about it, was between, my credit score was between 820 and 830, which is a really good credit score. Whoop-de-doo, I don't care about it, right? I'm not going to use it. And then we had a credit card through our credit union, and then the credit union a few years back started offering a card that had the 1.5% cash back. And so I use a credit card for online purchases, where you pretty much have to, or else you could use a debit card. Rarely do I use a credit card for in-person purchases. Occasionally, if there's special circumstances, but for the most part, I like to pay cash in person. But I use a credit card, like I said, for online purchases. So I use it as cash. I pay it off every day. Why not make it 1.5% cash back? That adds up over time. You can buy something, you know, fun for yourself. So anyway, I applied for the new credit card with Seth's name on it. So both of our names on it, because I wanted her name to be on it too. And then once I got the new card, I canceled the other card. Applied for the same credit limit. So now my credit limit was the same now as it was before. My credit score dropped from 830 or 820 or whatever it was down to like 750. Nothing's changed, right? I think what changed was my wife didn't have any credit history at all. And that probably, she dragged me down, basically, is what it comes down to, I guess. And now it's been going up. Now it's at like 781 or something, which, once again, meaningless. I don't care, right? It doesn't matter. But that's just the point. Like, yeah, if you have good credit, you shouldn't use it anyway. So who cares? So to a person who follows the Bible's precept about owe no man anything, remember that, Romans 13:8? A credit score is worthless because you'll never need it nor use it for anything. Now, Dave Ramsey really blows away this build your credit myth, even as it pertains to a home mortgage, because this is where people would say, yeah, I get it. Yeah, you don't use your credit to buy cars and furniture and student loans and whatever else. Yeah, all that stuff's stupid. But you got to have a mortgage, and that's true. Just about everybody does. I mean, that's especially today with house prices the way they are. It's very, very difficult to not have a mortgage. So how do you get a home mortgage if you don't have any credit, right? That's what they say. So you got to build your credit. That's actually not true, though. And Dave Ramsey does a good job of dispelling this myth. I'm going to read it to you out of his book here. This is from the Total Money Makeover. He says, the best myth is the build your credit myth. Bankers, car dealers, and unknowledgeable mortgage lenders have told America for years to, quote, build your credit. This myth means we have to get debt so we can get more debt, because debt is how we get stuff. I love that. Let me read that again. It's so funny. This myth means we have to get debt so we can get more debt, because debt is how we get stuff. I really like Ramsey. He kind of has like that sarcastic, hard-lined attitude, kind of like a certain preacher I know. And so I, you know, we're like kindred spirits. I like that kind of thing. Probably some people don't, but anyway. Those of us who have had a total money makeover have found that cash buys stuff better than debt. And that's true. But if I were selling debt, as the banker is, I also would tell you to get debt to get more debt. This, however, is a myth. Yes, you will need to, quote, build your credit by borrowing and repaying debt in a timely fashion if you want to live a life of credit cards, student loans, and car payments. Not me. The one question we must answer is, how do I get a home mortgage? Later, I will introduce you to the 100% down plan, or if you must, how to settle for a 15-year fixed-rate mortgage. But if you want that 15-year fixed-rate mortgage with a payment that's no more than 25% of your take-home pay, so I won't yell about it, don't you need credit? No, is his answer. You will need to find a mortgage company that does actual underwriting. That means they are professional enough to process the details of your life instead of using a Beacon score, lending for dummies, he says. You can get a mortgage if you have lived right. Let me define lived right. You can qualify for a conventional 15-year fixed-rate loan if, number one, you have paid your landlord early or on time for 2 years. Number two, you have been in the same career field for 2 years. Number three, you have a good down payment, which is more than nothing down. I would say 20%, but anyway. Number four, you have no other credit, good or bad. And number five, you are not trying to take too big of a loan. A payment that totals 25% of your take-home pay is conservative and will help you qualify. Don't let anyone tell you to go into debt to make way for a mortgage. That is a lie. A quality mortgage professional can get you into a home if he or she knows how to do underwriting. As for building credit for other stuff, leave that to the losers. Your total money makeover, or with your total money makeover, you won't be taking on that kind of debt anyway. And I don't remember the name of the place. I think it's Churchill Mortgage. I think that's the name of the company. I hear it on his show quite a bit. And that's one company. And if you ever need something like that, I can find that for you. Or you could find it from Ramsey. But that is a company that will do actual underwriting. And they, I don't know if they must specialize in this kind of thing. I don't know if it's the only thing they do. But anyway, they'll give mortgages to people who aren't on the hamster wheel of the credit score thing. You know, they just say, have you paid your rent for 2 years? Do you have 2 years of a stable career? You know, do you, and all the other stipulations there. And then you can get a mortgage. All right, now speaking of mortgages, I want to talk about how we should not buy a house or build a house until you are financially prepared to do so. This is really important because a lot of people end up screwing up in this area, and they end up getting themselves into a bind. They end up becoming what is called house poor, which I'll talk about in a minute. And then if things go south, they really end up in a bind because now they got this house that they really can't afford, and now income goes down, and the price of the home goes down. They can't even sell it because they're underwater. So there can be a lot of really bad things that can happen if you get into a house before you're financially prepared to do so. Let's look at Proverbs 24 and verse 27. And this is such a myth. Huge myth. How many of you have ever heard it said, if you are paying rent, you are wasting money? Have anybody ever heard you say, if you're paying rent, you're wasting money? That is the biggest lie and the stupidest thing ever. Now, if you are renting a 3,500 square foot home, yes, you are wasting money. That's true. But if you are renting a two-bedroom apartment, you are not wasting money. As a matter of fact, you are saving money. I will prove it to you. Not in this sermon, but later on, I will give you the numbers from my real life scenario, and I will prove it to you. You are literally saving money renting a two-bedroom apartment over owning. And when I say owning, I mean actually owning. I don't mean mortgaging. I mean if you owned your home outright, it is still cheaper to rent a two-bedroom apartment. At least here in this town, it is. Still cheaper. You will actually make money renting a two-bedroom apartment over owning your house outright. Now, do I recommend anybody does that, that's in a position to own your home outright? No, of course not. I mean, who wants to live in a two-bedroom apartment? It's okay, I've done it for years, but who wants to? I mean, if you could own a house, of course. I mean, for most people, that's preferable for all kinds of reasons. But financially, it's not going to help you out financially. Not according to the numbers that I've run anyway. But there are more reasons to own a house than finances. So anyway, but I'm getting ahead of myself again. Let's look at Proverbs 24 and verse 27. Proverbs 24, 27. Prepare thy work without and make it fit for thyself in the field, and afterwards build thine house. Prepare thy work without, make it fit for thyself in the field. In other words, get yourself into a good, stable, well-paying career. Save up some money, get things prepared without, and then build the house. But most people, I mean, as soon as they get out of college and get their first job and where they could qualify for a mortgage, they jump right into a house as soon as they possibly can, and they do it way too early. Then they get locked into a 30-year mortgage for the rest of their life, and then not only are they're really on like a 60-year mortgage. Because what they do is they get the 30-year mortgage. As soon as interest rates go down a little bit, they refinance, except they refinance for another 30 years. Instead of refinancing for another 25 or whatever the remainder of the balance is, or for 15 if you're smart, but they finance for another 30 years. And then a few years later, it goes down again, another 30 years. And before you know it, I'm 85 years old and I'm still paying off this same house that I've been paying off my entire life. Not a good plan. Not a good plan. So get financially prepared before you buy or build that house. I will explain here in just a minute what it means to be financially prepared. I didn't put it in the outline. I've mentioned it before. I plan to put it in the outline later. Look at, first of all, though, look at Proverbs 24 and verse 3. Through wisdom is an house builded, and by understanding it is established. I think this is true of whether you're speaking of a house in the sense of a household, like a family, or whether you're speaking of an actual brick and mortar house. Through wisdom is a house builded. If you build a house without wisdom, without financial wisdom, you're going to be in financial trouble. If you build a house without carpentry wisdom, you're also going to be in trouble because it's probably going to fall down around you or something bad's going to happen. So yeah, good idea to know what you're doing. If I was going to build a house, I would call Austin. I'm not going to build that thing myself. It'd probably fall down. Now, when I say don't buy or build a house until you're financially prepared. Now, I've been over this before, but here's how you know you're financially prepared to buy a house. Number one, you have no other debt. You got no car loans, you got no student loans, you got no credit cards, you got nothing. Your debt is totally paid off, if you ever had any. Number two, you've got 3 to 6 months emergency fund saved up. Because as Ramsey says, if you buy a house and you don't have a 3 to 6 month emergency fund set up, Murphy is going to take up residence in the spare bedroom. You ever heard of Murphy's Law? When something can go wrong, it will. A lot of people do that. They buy a house. They're right on the razor edge. They've got no savings, and they're just hoping that nothing goes wrong. Let me tell you something. Hope is not a plan. Hope is not a plan. The minute you move into that house, the HVAC goes out. Now what are you going to do? Now what are you going to do? Got to have that 3 to 6 months saved up, first of all. Then you want to be investing 15% of your gross income in retirement. Because if you go buy a house and you're not investing and your mortgage is going to take up all the money that you could have used to invest, what are you going to do when you get old and you got no money saved up, right? So you want to have no debt. You want to have 3 to 6 months savings, emergency fund. You want to be investing 15% of your gross income in retirement. You want to have a 20% down payment on that house. Years ago, 10 years ago, I did a series called Money Management, a little two-parter. I expanded it by about 15-fold this time and made it a 30-some-parter, okay? 10 years ago, I made that statement in that sermon. I said, if you can't afford a 20% down payment on your house, you can't afford the house. Should have been an uncontroversial statement. This is like back when I was a kid, this is just the way it was, right? I mean, for pretty much all of human history, I think, prior to the early 2000s when things went nuts, that's just the way it was. 20% down payment. Banks wouldn't give you a loan for a house if you didn't have a 20% down payment. Am I right? Pretty sure I'm right about that, right? That's just the way it was. For two reasons. Number one, they want you to have some skin in the game. If you buy a house with no down payment and the price of that house goes down even slightly when right after you buy it and then you lose your job, guess what? Underwater, can't sell it, you're going bankrupt, right? So that's one reason to have it. The other reason is the bank wants to see if you're actually going to be able to pay them back. And if you can save up 20%, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, the bank says, oh, this guy can actually manage his money. He's got a budget. He can save money, right? So he's credit worthy. So there's a reason for that. I made that statement in Minneapolis. Believe it or not, I think that that statement was the beginning of the end of that church. Crazy to think about. I couldn't absolutely prove it, but I found out later on that somebody was offended by that statement. And somebody became resentful because of that statement. And then there were some other statements that I made over the next 3 years in different sermons where just that just kept getting at her and made her more and more resentful. And I really think that had a lot to do with what happened in that church. So believe it or not, that one statement, 20% down payment, you can't afford the house, that blew up the church, possibly. Hopefully you don't despise me for it. I don't think you will. I think I probably said things that are far more offensive than that in the last 5 months here. So I think you'd be, if you were going to get mad, you probably would have already gotten mad, chances are. So anyway, back to how you can afford the house. 20% down payment, 15-year mortgage that is no more than 25% of your take-home pay. If you check off all those boxes, you are financially prepared to buy a house. If you don't check them off, you're not ready to buy a house yet. Now, sadly, today, for the average person, and this is not hyperbole, that's impossible. It's literally impossible for the average person to do that today because of where housing prices are. That's sad, and I'll prove it to you here in a minute. For the average person, I'm saying, average income. Or I'd say it's impossible to not do so within, I mean, you're going to be many, many, many years of saving to get to that point where you could do something like that. And I'll prove it to you. I'll show you what I'm talking about here. But back in the day when things were normal, you know, back like before the early 2000s, that was not any great feat. You know, a normal person could do that if he was disciplined and, you know, knew how to budget money. All right, so with today's interest rates, now, when I wrote this, this was probably a few months ago, so interest rates changed a little bit. I think they're a little lower than they are, or a little lower now. But at that time, it was 7.03%. At today's interest rates of 7.03%, financing a house with a small down payment for 30 years will end up costing you almost three times as much as the house is worth. So the average person that puts zero down or close to zero down, very small down payment on a 30-year mortgage, if he pays it off in 30 years, which is unlikely, but if he does, he's going to pay about three times what that house is worth because of interest. Now, if you must, you should get a 15-year mortgage rather than a 30-year. For one thing, the mortgage rate is lower. Mortgage rate is lower on a 15% loan or on a 15-year loan. A 15-year loan has a mortgage rate of 6.34%. Whereas a 30-year has a mortgage rate of 7.03, which is actually a big deal. That's a lot. You know, when you're talking three-quarters of a point, almost three-quarters of a point, that's a big deal. So a mortgage rate is way cheaper on a 15-year loan, for one thing. And then you have time working on your side, which makes that house way, way cheaper if you have a 15-year mortgage. Let me give you an example here. Consider the difference between financing a $250,000 house, which, you know, back when I was a kid was a really nice, big, beautiful house. Now it's just a barely average house, if you're lucky, in a little semi-impoverished town like Excelsior Springs in a halfway okay neighborhood. I mean, this is, you know, it's a $250,000 house is absolutely nothing today. It's just a house at best. But consider the difference between financing a $250,000 house with a 20% down payment, which would be $50,000, on a 30-year mortgage versus a 15-year mortgage. Now, these figures, the total paid figure, includes property taxes and insurance. $2,300 in property taxes per year, $2,000 in insurance, because those things are always wrapped into your loan. Okay, so your monthly payment on that 30-year mortgage is $1,693.14. On a 15-year mortgage, it's $2,083.17. That's only $390 more per month. You know that on the 15-year mortgage? Now, you would think if you didn't understand interest, you'd think, well, if a 30-year mortgage is $1,600 a month, then a 15-year mortgage is going to be $3,200 a month, right? It's going to cost twice as much because I'm paying on it for half the time, right? So I got to pay twice as much per month, right? That's what you'd think, right? If you didn't understand interest. But it's not double. A 15-year mortgage isn't double the monthly cost, not even close. It's only less than $400 per month, which is really not that much money. I mean, when you're spending this kind of money on a house. The total interest paid on a 30-year mortgage is $280,469.32. You bought a $250,000 house, and you even, in this case, you had a 20% down payment, so you only took out a loan for $200,000, and you paid $280,000 in interest. Think about that. You paid the bank more than twice what that house is worth in interest. Total interest on a 15-year loan is only, still a lot, but it's only $110,440.85. Look at how much interest you save on a 15-year mortgage versus a 30-year. You saved $170,000 in interest with a 15-year mortgage versus a 30-year. It had only cost you an extra $390 per month. Think about that. You know how far ahead you'll get if you are able to, once you pay that thing off in 15 years or less, and you have all that money freed up that you were paying that you can now invest, that you would otherwise be paying for the next 15 years on top of that. You know how far ahead you can get by using a 15-year mortgage over a 30? 10-year mortgage is even better than that, and a 5-year is better than that, and a 1-year is even better than that, and having none is the best of all, of course. The smaller, the lower term, lower time mortgage you can have, the best. Now, millionaires don't waste their money on 30-year mortgages. And as the old saying goes, that's why they're millionaires. That's one of the reasons. Here's a quote from Dave Ramsey's book, Baby Steps Millionaires. He said, in our national study of millionaires, we found that 67% of millionaires have a paid-off home. And it took them an average of 11.2 years to pay it off. Take that in for a moment. Millionaires don't spend 30 years paying off their house. And I would interject, that's why they're millionaires. They pay it off in roughly 10 years. They are also not living in a 10,000 square foot mansion. They live, on average, in a 2,600 square foot home that they've been in an average of 17 years. It's not your typical idea of the millionaires living in these big mansions and so on. And, you know, that's not what most millionaires do. 2,600 square foot house is a nice sized house. You know, that's a big house, but it's not some mansion. You see, millionaires live below their means when it comes to their houses. Again, that's why they're millionaires. Millionaires, on average, live in houses that are slightly smaller than the average new American home. Did you know that? Millionaires live in homes that are slightly smaller than the average new American home. Here's again from Dave Ramsey's Baby Steps Millionaires. The millionaires in this study, that's the National Study of Millionaires, live in relatively modest homes located in ordinary neighborhoods. The U.S. Census Bureau states that the average square footage of a new American home is around 2,660 square feet. The National Studies of Millionaires found that the random sample's average home size is actually slightly smaller at 2,600 square feet. Now, Dave Ramsey recommends that your mortgage payment should be no more than 25% of your take-home pay on a 15-year mortgage. And this 25% is not set in stone, obviously, but it's based on, well, I think it's not even his idea. I think this is pretty much standard suggestion out there in the financial world, right around that 25% mark. But if you go higher than the 25%, and if you go significantly higher than that, yeah, 26, maybe you'd be all right, 27, who knows. But when you get up there and you get closer, and some people are up at like 50% of their take-home pay going to their mortgage, that's crazy. Because if you're doing what he says, which I think is wise, if you're giving 10% to the Lord, if you're putting 15% in investments, there's 25% already. If your mortgage takes up 50%, you're down to living on 25%, less than 25% of your take-home pay. And you still have to pay for food, utilities, home maintenance, which people don't even think about, which I'll talk about here in a second, and everything else, all that stuff. And you become what is called house poor. And there's a lot of people that are in that situation. You just don't have enough to cover your living expenses and to meet your saving and giving responsibilities. Now, unfortunately, based on this wise guideline of 15-year mortgage, no more than 25% of your take-home pay, buying an average home today in America is impossible for the average family. And I'm not being a pessimist. I'm just going to give you some math here. Let's first look at an example from our own local area here in Excelsior Springs. At today's housing prices and interest rates, that means that to buy a $250,000 house, like I said, is just a normal house around here these days. Not nothing fancy. It's not a bad house, but it's not a great house, right? It's just a house. To buy the $250,000 more house, even if you had a 20% down payment with a 15-year mortgage, you would have to have an annual take-home pay of $99,992, basically $100,000. You have to have $100,000 of take-home pay to be able to afford a $250,000 house on a 15-year mortgage with a 20% down payment. If you had less than a 20% down payment, you'd have to make even more to be able to afford that payment. This would mean you'd have to have an annual gross income of about $125,000 because, you know, you got to subtract about 20% for taxes or so. So for somebody to buy just a normal house in Excelsior Springs, you'd have to have $125,000 of family income. How many people in Excelsior Springs have a family income of $125,000? Like, very few, probably less than 10%, 5%. I don't know, very, very few in Excelsior Springs. Okay, so somebody say, we'll just go up to a 30-year mortgage. Okay, so go up to a 30-year mortgage. To finance the same house with a 30-year mortgage, one would have to have an annual take-home pay of $81,270, which would be an annual gross income of $101,000. So for a 30-year mortgage, $250,000 house, and you've already put 20% down, you've already put $50,000 down, which how many people are doing that today? Probably about none. Even with that, you'd have to make over $100,000 to afford the payment on that house for it to be 25% of your take-home pay. Again, how many people in Excelsior Springs make $100,000 a year? Not very many. According to census.gov, in 2023 dollars, the per capita income in Missouri is $38,497. That's per capita per person, right? And the median household income is $68,920. So the median household income is under $70,000. And to buy that house, even on a 30-year mortgage with a big down payment, you'd still have to make $100,000 take home. A guy making 69 take home is not making 69,000. That's his gross income. He's making a lot less than that take home. A normal house in Excelsior Springs is completely out of his reach. Completely. And this is the median. This is the average income of the average person in Missouri. This means that the average family in Excelsior Springs today cannot even come close to affording an average priced home using a 15 or a 30-year mortgage. And like I said, that's with a 20% down payment of 50 grand, which lowers the mortgage payment. Now let me give you a national example. This is even worse. This is what blows me away. I love Dave Ramsey, but I think he's out to lunch on this. Because he has said repeatedly that housing prices are never coming down. The right time to buy a house is when you can afford one. If you can afford it, just buy it. Housing prices are never coming down. When I read you these statistics, you tell me if you agree that housing prices are never coming down. They've got to come down. Or people just flat out cannot afford houses, period. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. This is why I think we're heading for a huge housing market crash, and I certainly hope so. As of May 2025, the national median household income is $83,150. And I have the source there. You get the outline, you can click on the link, it take you to that source. That's the median income. So you take the whole population, find the person right in the middle, and that's what he's making, household income, 83,000. That means that the median household take-home pay is approximately $5,543. I've taken 20% out for taxes, okay? So the median household has a take-home pay of about $5,500 per month. According to the home affordability calculator on RamseySolutions.com, this is Dave Ramsey's site, following the no more than 25% of your take-home pay with a 15-year mortgage rule, that means that the average family can only afford a $140,000 house with a 20% down payment of $28,000 a year. So if you use that formula, 15-year mortgage, no more than 25% of your take-home pay, you're making $5,500 a month, you can only afford a $140,000 house. Now, have you been on Realtor.com in the last several years? Have you seen what kind of houses sell in Excelsior Springs for $140,000? Or anywhere in the country, for that matter? That's what the average person in the country can afford, is that. That's some sad deal right there. This would be a payment of $1,386 per month. $1,386, that's 25% of the take-home pay. That's 25% of the $5,500, right? That's what will get you. A $1,300 payment will get you, if you had $28,000 down payment, would get you that $140,000 house. Crazy. Now it gets worse. According to RamseySolutions.com, the median home price today, this is July 2025 in America, is $440,000. The median home price, I'll say it again, in America today is $440,000. Home prices are a little lower here in Excelsior Springs than they are in other places, right? But just go on Realtor and look up a new home, a new construction home in Excelsior Springs, and guess what you're going to find? Darn close to that. 400,000, high 300s, low 400s, mid 400s. This is what a normal new home costs, $440,000. Now get this. I'd love to call into the Ramsey Show and ask this question based on his own numbers. That means that the average family in America would have to save up a down payment of $327,796 to afford the average house on a 15-year mortgage. The average family has to save up $327,000 for a down payment to be able to afford a mortgage on a $140,000 mortgage. On a $440,000 house. Now, even if the average American family used a 30-year mortgage, which Ramsey strongly advises against, they could only afford a $183,000 house with a 20% down payment of $36,000, $36,728, which is the same monthly price, $1,386, right? Same monthly price, whether it's the 15-year or the 30-year, you can only afford what you can afford. You can only afford 25% of your take-home pay, which for the median American household is $1,386. So that $1,386 on a 30-year mortgage would only get you a $183,000 house. But the average house costs $440,000. So what does that mean? It means that the average American family would have to save up a down payment of $293,000 to afford the average house with a 30-year mortgage. This is why I say that it is absolutely impossible for the average American family to buy the average house in America today. Absolutely impossible, unless you're going to save up money for decades. That's it. These numbers show that housing is astronomically unaffordable today. And we need a huge crash in the housing market, and it can't come soon enough. Yes, I know it would hurt some people. It would help most people. It really wouldn't hurt that many people. If you already own your house, if you own it free and clear, like if you're older and you paid it off or whatever, it doesn't matter one iota, right? If you paid $200,000 for your house and it's now worth $400,000, what's it matter? It's not real value. It's not realized gain. You can't spend that $400,000, right? The only time it would matter is if you sold your house and you were going to rent. Then if you sold your $400,000 house and rented, yeah, you'd have $400,000 versus if the market crashed and you sold it for $200,000, you'd only have $200,000. Only if you're going to sell it and rent. If you're going to sell it and buy another house, it doesn't matter. You're going to sell your $400,000 house and you're going to buy another $400,000 house. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if your house is worth $10 or $1 million. If the house next door is worth the same price, it doesn't matter. The price means nothing, right? It would be bad for people who just bought the house at highly inflated prices and then the housing market crashes. That wouldn't be good. But it would certainly be better for a whole generation of young people who cannot buy a house right now. It's impossible for them to buy a house. It would make a big difference for them. So yeah, it would hurt some people, but it would help a ton of people. Another thing you have to consider when it comes to homeownership is the cost of owning it and maintaining it. And a lot of people, I don't think, really give that a second thought. They think, as long as I can make the mortgage payment, I'm good. Well, no, you're not, because you have a whole lot of other expenses. I'm going to quote here from an article called Average Home Maintenance Costs from HomeGuide.com. It says, financial experts recommend budgeting 1% to 4% of a home's value each year for maintenance and repairs. This means that for a $250,000 house, one should budget between $2,500 and $10,000 per year for house maintenance, depending on the age, condition, and features of the house. Minimum, $2,500, which is a couple hundred bucks a month at an absolute minimum. This means setting aside $208 to $833 per month for house maintenance. This would cover routine maintenance tasks such as AC tune-ups, AC coil cleaning, dryer vent cleaning, furnace cleaning, air duct cleaning, landscape maintenance, gutter cleaning, deck sealing or staining, painting, chimney sweeping, tile and grout cleaning, window cleaning, carpet cleaning, plumbing repair, electrical repair, and appliance repair, and a bunch of other stuff. Now, if you're handy, you can do some or all these things by yourself, but you better be prepared to spend a lot of time maintaining your property if you're going to do all that yourself. So you could save a lot of that money doing it yourself. That's true. And you could also spend a lot of time doing it. So setting aside money every month will build up a house maintenance fund that can be used for larger maintenance costs, such as the following. So this is why I recommended, when I talked about budgeting and I talked about the sinking funds, right, to have a house maintenance fund. And that's why, Lord willing, someday when we buy a house, I'm going to not just take that money I was spending for rent and think, oh, it's time to go have some fun. No, that all that rent money, guess what it's going to do? It's going to go towards taxes, insurance, and home maintenance. I'm not going to spend a penny of that. I'll probably have to add to it, as a matter of fact. It's going to be more expensive to own a house than it will be to rent. But all that money, yeah, is just going to be put away towards house maintenance. It includes things like this. Water heater replacement. This is from that article. Between $600 and $3,100 for that. They say every 8 to 12 years. Sadly, with the way stuff is produced these days, stuff doesn't last. It used to be, you know, water heater lasts forever. My water heater in my grandmother's house was almost 60 years old. My dad patched it up a couple of times, but try getting 60 years out of a water heater today. You know, try getting 10, 15 maybe, I don't know. Appliance replacement, anywhere between $350 and $1,700. I don't know what kind of an appliance you can replace for $350 these days. Maybe a toaster or something. But I don't think you can replace any other appliance for that price. Every 10 to 15 years. Roof replacement, $5,700, good luck. To $16,000 every 15 to 20 plus years. Gutter replacement, $750. That's probably for the estimate. $750 to $2,300 every 15 to 30 years. Window replacement, $4,500 per window, that is. $4,500 to $22,500 every 15 to 30 years. HVAC system replacement, $5,000 to $16,000 every 15 to 25 years. Exterior house painting, $1,900 to $6,900 every 5 to 10 years. Exterior siding replacement, $10,000 to $32,500 every 20 to 40 plus years. So that just gives you an idea of things, some of which are going to happen. Yes, you could not paint your house, and yeah, it could eventually rot away or whatever. Yeah, you could not replace your gutters, and then your foundation will be screwed up later when you know. Yeah, you can not replace all this stuff. You can not replace your windows and have, you know, a nice draft coming through your house and pay $500 a month for heating or whatever. You can do all that, right? But there's certain things you're going to have to replace, like the roof, right? And if you don't replace the roof, you're not going to have a house for long, right? So there are just going to be costs that are going to happen, and that's why it's imperative to put money away every month into that house maintenance fund because stuff is going to happen. Murphy is going to move in to the spare bedroom if you don't have that house maintenance fund. So like I said, home ownership is expensive, even if you have your mortgage paid off. And I'll have more to say about that. Like I said, it's actually more expensive to own a paid off home than it is to rent a two-bedroom apartment. Or said another way, it's cheaper to live in a two-bedroom apartment, at least in this town, than it is to live in a paid-off house. And I will give you the numbers to prove it here later on in this study. I don't know when that'll be. It'll be several weeks from now, probably. So if you don't believe me, just hold your seats. I'll give you the numbers. So let's see. Okay, I'm going to have to call it quits today. We'll pick it up there next time, Lord willing. I didn't quite get through everything, but that's all right. We still have communion today, so I don't want to go too long. So I thank you for your kind and patient attention this morning.